more. You're my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singin' Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, Marvin Miller continues to remember radio.
Has anybody got a match? Thanks. Now I can light an old gold and listen to Frank Sinatra.
Night and day. You are the one. Only you beneath the moon or under the sun.
Why, Francis Langford, I don't think Frankie's so thin. Why, you told me he looked like a piccolo with a bow tie.
Jenny Sims, I said no such thing. I merely said if Frankie were mine, I'd trade him in on a big job.
Hey, well, who was ever responsible for that yakada-yakada police button up there? Oh, Jenny Sims and Francis Langford.
Francis, I'm scared. He's a wolf.
Don't be scared, Jenny. This wolf's mother was frightened by a cocker spaniel.
Say, you gals talking about me?
Oh, Mr. Sinatra, I'm afraid we've interrupted your broadcast, and well, we're sorry.
Correction, dear, you're sorry.
Yeah, one of you seems slightly more enthusiastic than the other.
Well, Frank, it's just that every week for the past 2 years, Jenny has phoned me and said, Francis, is this the week we go to see Frankie's broadcast? And every week I've said, no, Jenny, I'm sorry, Jenny, but no, Jenny.
But this week, things are different.
Different how?
We finally got our mitts on a couple of tickets.
Well, now that you two queens have finally paid us a visit, I want you to know you got to help with the housework. I'll take off on the tune I was about to sing, and then we'll talk over your duties.
What are you warbling, Frankie boy?
Well, this is a song that my father sang the day that I was born. He came to the hospital, looked into the incubator, and said, hey, that's no you, hey.
Across my pillow, as soft as a will-o'-the-wisp, and in its song there is sadness because there's no you. The lonely autumn tree, how softly they're sighing, 'cause summer is dying. They know that in my heart there's no gladness because there's no you. The park that we walked in, the garden we talked in, how lonesome they seem in the fall. Stormy clouds hover and falling leaves cover our favorite nook in the wall. In spring we'll meet again. Kiss and recapture that summertime rapture we knew. And from that day, nevermore will I say, there's no you.
Francis and Ginny, I've got a small worry.
This boy is bucking Crosby, and he calls that a small worry.
Now, wait a minute. No, I mean it, honestly. You see, you two gals are big stars, and we want to give credit to your sponsors. But I've been wondering, could we do it musically?
Oh, but yes, Frankie. We'd love to mention our sponsors musically.
Well, swell. The Pied Pipers would be glad to back you up, and there's no charge for this, by the way.
If half the time you don't feel right and you don't sleep well at night, use Borden's products and you feel like a load of dynamite.
Francis, same tune, different sponsor, different network.
If half the time your smile's a sight, if your molars are a fright, use Pepsodent each morn and night, and your teeth will be so bright.
You know, it takes all the willpower I can muster, Buster, not to sing my 30-minute aria about old gold. But honest, gals, in return for that plug, you said you'd pay off for a song. With a song, rather. So how's about if we start collecting, Francis?
On the dotted line, Frankie.
Axel, get in there and help collect your 10%.
Deep in my heart calls to you, calls to you. I live in the memory of many dreams ago, when the stars were bright and you were mine alone. My love for you cannot die, run dry, for heaven's fall from the sky.
My mother always told me, son, whenever you get to feeling blue and low down on the molehill, well, just get that Francis Langford to sing for you and it'll make you feel like a big man. That was good advice, and so is this.
When you're feeling lonely and you phone your one and only all the way from Frisco to Kankakee, and she says, hello, Sylvester, but it happens your name's Chester. Why be irritated like an OG?
Next time you light a cigarette, any cigarette, I want you to...
One of the biggest joys I had in those days of radio, so far as the musical shows were concerned, was the Frank Sinatra show. And Frank had the reputation of being a difficult guy to get along with. I never found it so. Everybody who surrounded him liked him very much. We had Axel Stordahl's orchestra, And we had the Pied Pipers and an array of girl guest stars and some male guest stars that would knock your eyes out. Really something super. The show was written by a chap named Wheaton, who had originally been the writer for Bing Crosby. And he had the same casual approach. It's some funny, funny things. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, since I got me a cigarette with Latakia, nothing seems to jar my serenity. For a future bright and sunny, try a smoke with apple honey. Why be irritated like an OG?
Well, Jenny Sims, have you picked out your number?
Yes, but Frankie, I'm so nervous singing in front of you.
Well, I'll turn around, honey. There, I've just turned around.
Gee, like a broom straw, you look the same on both sides.
Get me my hammer. Come on, Sim, simmer down and let's have a sample of that stuff that's got every bachelor from Upper Maine to Lower Cal going, hubba, 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 hubba.
Well, Franklin, I declare you're getting to talk more like Deems Taylor every day.
This girl fractures me. Sing.
Kiss me once, kiss me twice, kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You never know many dreams I dreamed about you. Oh, just how empty they all seemed without you. So kiss me once, kiss me twice, kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Twice then, kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time. Haven't felt like this, my dear, since can't remember when. It's been a long, long time. You'll never know how many dreams about you. Oh, just how empty they all seem without you. So kiss me once, kiss me twice, then kiss me once again.
Wonderful, Ginny. Absolutely wonderful.
Oh, thank you, Frankie. Frankie, thank you so much.
I think she likes me.
Hey, Sinatra.
More women. Oh. It's Junie Hutton and the Pied Pipers. What are you piping tonight, Pipers?
I like a tune called Paper Moon.
He likes a tune called Paper Moon.
Let's see if June likes Paper Moon.
Let's sing the tune.
It's only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Baby, without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love,
it's a melody played
in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Baby, it's only a paper moon hanging over a cardboard sea.
But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Only a canvas sky so high, so high, hanging there. You belong to me. Hey, now, without your love, it's a honky-tonk affair.
Without your love,
it's a mess, mess, losing my hair. Barnum and Bailey world, just as hokey as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe, I'd be so relieved if you believed in me.
Piper's like the pleats on a zoot suit that was reaped.
And sweet. But Frankie, Francis and I want to put a little pressure on you to sing all the things you are, okay?
Well, this is one pressure group on which I definitely approve.
You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long. You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and
thank you very much, Axel and the Pied Pipers. And Marv Miller, step up here, laddie. I'd like to talk to you.
Talk to me, boss. Talk to me.
Marvin, I know that your hobby is musical research, and I've got a little song here that I...
Well, know. Let's see it, boss. You know, I can tell in a jiff if it's an old master. I don't seem to recognize this ditty.
Well, let's sing it, Marv. Maybe that'll jog your medulla oblongata.
Okay, boss.
Apple, honey.
So far as the Sinatra show was concerned, the reason I like it was that I had a chance to not only chat with Frank on the air and, you know, do funny little vignette things. They even let me sing once in a while. And they did a special version of Frankie and Johnny with Francis Langford, Ginny Sims, and me with one brief stanza as a singing bartender. I'll never forget that one.
Ah, you can say that again.
You say it again.
You bet I'll say it again. In 1760, the Lorillard business was founded. That's why when you light an Old Gold, you enjoy the savory, smooth-smoking goodness which results from nearly two centuries of tobacco experience. In those two centuries, while America was building a great nation, Lorillard was building a great cigarette. Now, mind you, we're not comparing the two in the same breath. America is something big, and Old Gold is something little.
Yes, but friends, in America, it's the little things that count.
Right, Frank. And what counts in a cigarette is the comfort and pleasure you get with each puff. So, folks, if you want to get extra flavor, extra mellowness, extra bouquet, get Old Golds. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Old Gold corn-fed opera. Tonight's musical melodrama is a very tender love story. Very tender. In fact, medium rare. It's entitled Frankie and Johnny. Frankie and Ginny. Ginny will play Ginny, and Frankie will play Frankie. The other woman...
That's me.
The other woman, the Cyrene with store-bought clothes and darn little of them, will be played by Frances Langford. We raise the Old Gold curtain to present Frankie and Ginny.
True as the stars above.
Frankie, you're my man, but you're doing me wrong.
Cut, cut, that's the end of Act One. Now, Act Two.
Frankie and Ginny are walking. Frankie has on a new suit that Ginny bought for $100.
Just so my Frankie would look cute, he is my man. But he's doing me wrong.
Well, Ginny, honey, here we are out walking, and I'm wearing this nice $100 suit that you bought me. I wonder what people are saying about my new suit.
Take it off, take it off, it's a fit in the rear.
Ginny, dear, come over here and sit on my lap, what there is of it.
What you all got on your mind, Frankie boy?
Never mind what I got on my mind, gal. It's what I got on my lap that counts. But seriously, love boat, Ginny dear, I've got to go now. And I won't be very long. And don't you call up for me, honey. No worry while I'm gone.
You've got a date, my pal, with that Langford gal.
Oh, please, Virginia, please, and no such of a thing. Now, you run along home like a good little gal. Don't be so suspicious and jealous.
Me?
Yes, yes, yes. Just trot home, gal, and stir up a couple of soup sandwiches, and I'll be around the consequently.
All right, Frankie. I'll go home. Bye, Frankie.
Says here, laughs a la Rudolph Rosendale. Goodbye, Ginny.
Frankie thinks I'm going home, but I'm going to follow him. Will Frankie go down to the 3.2 parlor? Will Frankie meet that Langford gal? Tomorrow's episode of Queen for a Day will tell the tale. But no, I must know the answer tonight. So, I'm going down to the corner, down where they sell that 3.2. Say to that fat bartender, have you seen my Frankie boy? He is my man, but I think he's doing me wrong.
Oh, ain't gonna tell you no story. I ain't gonna tell a lie to you, Ma. But you, Frank, you went by just an hour ago with that Francis Langford doll.
I'm right, he's doing me wrong.
You're right, he's doing you wrong.
I can see all the lawyers now, thicken blowflies in a bucket of buttermilk. I made it.
Act three. Ginny is looking for her man, Frankie. After Frankie leaves Ginny, he doubles back on South Clark Street. And as Act Three begins, Frankie is knocking on the door of the other woman's apartment, played by Frances Langford. I mean, Frances plays the other woman, not the apartment.
Hello, tall, dark, and famished.
Hi there, Frances. How's about a little date tonight, hmm?
You mean you want to go out and have some fun? Okay, two-ton.
It's Ginny.
Hi. Want to buy a victory bond?
Ginny, honey.
Oh, don't you Ginny, honey, me. Hey.
But, Ginny, I thought you grabbed a taxi and went home.
That's what you both thought, but I got me out on South Clark Street and threw a pane in the glass. Saw Frankie, my man, and love him. That Francis Langford lass, Frank, if you're my man, you sure are doing me wrong.
Listen, Wholesome, what's the big idea of busting in here like this? And put down that gun, it may be empty. Ginny, your cause is hopeless. Frankie was your man, but
one day he came along, this man you love. Not very big and strong, this man you love. Francis, how could you do this to me? You and I have been lifelong friends. Why, you knew that Frankie means everything to me. You knew that he's my everything. Rolled up into one. Rolled him out pretty thin, didn't they?
Well, I guess there's only one way to settle this argument.
That's right. We'll ask Frankie to choose.
Yeah, tell us, two-ton, which one of us are you, sweetheart?
Well, gals, I'll tell you, it's like this. In the words of our theme song, drive out my rubber-tied carriage. Drive out my rubber-tied hack. I'm sweet on a chick in Milwaukee, and I'm gonna hurry back.
Well, how do you like that?
Well, Francis, he's ditching the both of us.
Draw that gun, sister. He's trying to get away.
Frankie sees trouble coming. Out the back door, he does scoots. But Ginny takes aim with her pistol, and the gun goes.
Thank you very much, Frances Langford and Ginny Sims. Folks, however, I got some bad news for you. She missed me. Well, sir, unless anybody wants to hem a hanky or bob for a couple of Jonathans, I think we can safely assume that it's time to put your dreams away for another day. Wishing on a star never got you far. And so it's time to make a new star. Hey, we got to get out of here. On account of we got to grab a train. On account of we got to meet Gene Kelly in New York. On account of we've had so many requests to cut a small slice of Anchors Away that Navy has let Gene off for next Wednesday's show. October 27th is Navy Day, but next Wednesday will be Navy Gene Kelly's Day on the Old Gold Show. So thanks, everybody, and bend your ears east next Wednesday. And hey, Gene Kelly, hey. There's one thing I want to ask you. First thing I get to New York. How many times have you seen Anchors Away?
Next Wednesday and every Wednesday is the night for Songs by Sinatra, presented by Old Gold, whose choice tobaccos are specially conditioned to help guard against cigarette dryness and to give you more smoking pleasure. And say, don't let little annoyances get you down. Why be irritated? Light an Old Gold. The Frank Sinatra Show is written by Glenn Wheaton and produced and directed for Old Gold by Man Holliner. This is Marvin Miller speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Another case of having been identified with a show and staying with it for many years that I missed by the skin of my teeth was when Ozzie and Harriet left Red Skelton and formed their own show. I don't suppose many people remember that Ozzie and Harriet were with Red for, a long number of years. Ozzie led the band, Harriet did a vocal, but Harriet also played the mother to the mean widow Kid, who was one of Red's priceless characterizations. And everybody knew she read comedy very well, and Ozzie was kind of funny, and they kind of thought it would be a good idea to start their own show. So they came to me and said, "We know what you did for Red. Would you be our announcer?" So I took the thing up with my agent. At that time, I was handled by MCA, perish forbid. And they advised me against it. They said, "It's another family situation show. It has no future." And Vern Smith became the announcer, and he kept it until his death. Of course, that's one of the longest-running shows in any medium that you can think of. It ran for, I don't remember how many years into the 20s, but counting radio and television, I know it ran very close to 30 years. Both of their young kids grew up on the show. In fact, when it was on originally, it had been played, their roles had been played by two very young child actors who were professional. And it wasn't until David and Ricky got old enough to be able to read that they could let them play their own roles. But at least as a reward, Ozzie used to call me on just about every other show. And I did a lot of funny roles on that show. I also did a lot of roles on Burns and Allen. And this goes back to the business of whether you could get the studio audience to laugh. If an actor knew how to read his lines and he knew how to leave the right pauses, by golly, he got the laugh. Sometimes it was a mug. It wasn't even in the line. You just looked at the audience and they roared. And if you could ensure that, you could get many, many callbacks. As a matter of fact, I was almost a regular with Burns and Allen, and then they finally went into television. And I was the guy on their pilot. I don't mean as an announcer, but doing the funny bit with Gracie, where she gets somebody always terribly confused. And that was the first show that was shown. And they called me back. I couldn't make the second one for some reason or other, which I can't remember. And I never got called again. So I might have been a regular on the Burns and Allen show, but wasn't. Incidentally, Ozzie did call me back on their television show quite a number of times. I worked as a guest with them. I had the reputation for a while of getting along with people who were difficult to get along with. And that was people like Sinatra and Billy Burke. And I found that to be completely untrue in both cases, by the way. Sinatra was late for rehearsal once or twice, but he never did anything that wasn't showmanlike and completely professional on his show, and everybody loved him. Billy was an elderly lady and had to have certain creature comforts, but she was the sweetest thing on wheels, and nobody could ever say anything against Billy. The other two shows that I worked on, which the star was supposed to be a martinet or difficult to get along with, one of them was the Rudy Valley show, and on Rudy Valley's show, I was the second announcer, the commercial announcer, actually, as opposed to the program announcer. But I also did parts. And to this day, Rudy and I are good friends, both honorary members of the L.A. Greater L.A. Press Club. We always see each other on big special evenings there. And Rudy's a great talker, you know. But he often says to me, we ought to get something back on radio. And nothing would please him any more than to get a regular syndicated radio show of reminiscences, believe me. In fact, knowing that I do a radio show, he once called me and asked who my distributor was. But, you know, who knows? Ray and Rudy is still, I hate to use the term, but it's true, remarkably well-preserved for somebody who started back in the 20s and is still a pretty doggone good showman. And I found it interesting to work Rudy's show. Rudy's biggest problem was he had fits of temper. He couldn't stand stupidity. And if anybody did anything that he just wasn't thinking, Rudy would blow his top. But outside of that, I didn't find him difficult to work with at all. I thought he was a delight. The only one of the people who was reputed to be difficult to work with, who was difficult to work with, was Ed Gardner, the maestro, the originator and star of Duffy's Tavern.
Makers of Mom, the safer deodorant, and Vitalis for well-groomed hair, bring you Duffy's Tavern, transcribed with our guest tonight, Bob Crosby, and starring Archie himself, Ed Gardner.
Hello, Duffy's Tavern, where the elite meet the eat. Archie the manager speaking. Duffy ain't here. Oh, hello, Duffy. Tonight, Bob Crosby. No, Duffy. Bob Crosby. Yeah, ersatz.
And Ed, well, de mortuis nil nisi bonum, as the saying goes, and since Ed is no longer with us, there's no need to go into detail. But Ed was a tough man, and the reason there were so many Miss Duffys on the show was due very largely to the fact that he really dished it out as a director. He was tough. Miss Duffy was originally played by Shirley Booth, as most people know, to whom he was married at the time. And the second Miss Duffy was Florence Hallop, and among others were Gloria Erlanger, Florence Robinson, Hazel Shermett, but the one I worked with most of the time was Sandra Gould. And Sandy's still around doing funny voices for television, like crazy. I don't know whether she's the gal on the Culligan spots, but she sure could be, because she's got that kind of a voice. She was one of the phone operators on the old Jack Benny show, the one with the high Brooklyn voice. A very cute gal, looks exactly the same as she did for 20 years. But he was tough on her, very tough. The only one who really seemed to stand the gaff and never have any problems was Charlie Cantor, who played Clifton Finnegan, who was the duh character in the tavern. And Eddie Green, as Eddie the waiter, was in it for many years. I don't know whether he stayed there all those years. I was his announcer, though, and I managed to weather two seasons of that program. Probably one of the most rewarding shows that I was on for a long, long time was Father Knows Best. Father Knows Best, of course, starred Robert Young. It was a radio show for many years, long before it became a television series. I had no connection with the television series except playing on it a couple of times, but I was the announcer on it during all the years it was on for Maxwell House, because in those days I did very many Maxwell House commercials. General Foods was also the sponsor of Burns and Allen at that time, and I seemed to kind of move from one to the other. But it was a delight working with all the people on the radio cast of Father Knows Best, and Bob Young is a prince and a nice guy, and it was a good show.
Time for the Coronet Storyteller. For dramatic, interesting, stimulating entertainment for every member of the family, read Coronet Magazine. Listen to the Coronet Storyteller. And here is tonight's story. The play's the thing.
On the stage of a certain theater on West 44th Street in New York, a cast of actors was rehearsing a new play. The following evening was opening night, and so it was no wonder that the director, a virile though aging man with a great leonine shock of white hair, drove his cast to the limits of their endurance. In vain, one member of the cast after another turned to him and pleaded,
Mr. Belasco, can't we take a rest?
David Belasco, the great director, was adamant. This was the dress rehearsal, and if he couldn't get the kind of performance he wanted out of the cast now, then by heaven, he'd keep him there all night. And so the insatiable Belasco drove his cast on and on, drove them until the lines came from their lips mechanically, until their faces were dull with fatigue. The great director tried to make them come alive with every trick in his bag. He flattered, pleaded, cajoled, threatened, stormed, wheedled. But it was no use. The play went by on leaden feet. And then finally the notoriously unstable Belasco exploded. He ranted, he raved, he swore, he stamped his feet, tore his shirt, waved shreds at his cast. He grew purple in the face. And then with a scream of sheer fury, he ripped a watch from his pocket and smashed it down upon the stage with all his might. Then, still roaring his anger, the director jumped up and down upon the shattered watch until it was ground into a thousand pieces. The cast was deathly still. Belasco, his face still working, staggered back, fell into a chair. He covered his face with his hands. His shoulders shook convulsively, and he began to sob.
"Oh, my God,"
he cried.
"My mother's watch. My dear dead mother's watch. The only thing in the world I had to remember her by. Smash, smash, gone."
He sobbed unrestrainedly for a long moment. Then his sobs slowly subsided. Lifting a tear-streaked face, he gazed sadly, contritely at the alarmed actors.
"Forgive me, children,"
he said in a quiet, broken-hearted voice.
"I'm so ashamed of myself. So ashamed."
There was a pause. Then brokenheartedly he said,
Won't you try it once more, just for me? Just for an old man. I'm so tired."
His voice trailed away into the emptiness of the auditorium, and his great dark eyes looked pleadingly at his cast. Who could withstand that appeal? The actors and actresses jumped to their places and began their lines once more. But this time, with what a difference. It was an inspired performance engendered by true emotion. And the great Belasco, easing himself wearily into a seat in the front row, watched his cast's enthusiastic artistry and whispered to his assistant,
"That went over big, didn't it? Remind me to buy another one of those dollar watches tomorrow."
So many of you have requested copies of these stories that Coronet Magazine is printing a collection of Coronet's storyteller tales for you. Series 1, in booklet form, contains the first 23 stories broadcast on this program and will be off the press in a few days. You can own this highly entertaining Coronet storyteller booklet with 23 complete stories simply by sending 10 cents along with your name and address to Coronet, 155 East Walton, Chicago 11. Remember, please send 10 cents for postage and handling to Coronet, 155 East Walton. That's 155 East Walton, Chicago 11. And you'll receive Series 1 of the Coronet Storyteller. Same time tomorrow night, same station, your Coronet Storyteller will bring you another story based on documentary material, A Very Fancy Flight. Until then, remember, read Coronet Magazine. Listen to the Coronet Storyteller.
This is the Blue Network. This is WENR at your service, Chicago 54.
I mentioned earlier that I had done the Coronet Storyteller in Chicago, and it was one show that I brought out to the coast with me. When it finally went off the air, about 3 years after I came to California, it launched me on a series of so-called storytelling shows. The Coronet Storyteller was only a 5-minute show, but I started the show for the same advertising agency out of Chicago, not connected with Coronet Magazine, however, as the original show had been. This was wide open. It dealt with any subject that anybody wanted to think about or talk about or read about. And the name behind the story was given to it because it was actually factual material that was known superficially, but the details or interesting angles or untold portions or maybe even correct accounts were not generally known, hence the name Behind the Story. And the world was our oyster. We could talk about anything. We did unsolved crimes. We did psychic phenomena. We did the real stories of people like John Smith and Captain Kidd. Captain Kidd wasn't a pirate, you know. He was actually an authorized privateer for the British government who got railroaded by the bankers who were very envious of the cash that he'd buried. John Smith never even met Pocahontas, let alone being saved by her. This was a famous exaggeration. John Smith actually was the Baron Munchausen of his century. The stories he wrote in his book couldn't have happened, and they make a very interesting reading. But that's the kind of a show we did, and the nice part of it, so far as I was concerned, was it was written in a sort of a storytelling way. It was a yarn that I had to spin, and there'd be little vignette scenes in it, and I would then play all the parts. That show went on for 9 years, 8 years under the name of Behind the Story. Finally, in 57, when the Don Lee Network, it had already left the Mutual Network earlier in 57 and remained on the Don Lee Network, at which point I was the writer, producer. I bought the scripts from other writers. I couldn't possibly write five shows a week. But when it finally went off the air in 57, it was gobbled up by CBS Pacific under the name of Marvin Miller Storyteller. And I did the same show, used the same scripts, in fact, in many cases, because I had 8 years of them, and they were timeless. That went on for another year on the Pacific branch of CBS. So I got a pretty good run out of that series, Behind the Story. I'll always remember it. I still get fan mail from people saying, why don't you put it back on radio? Maybe we can find a little piece of stuff to play from one of them.
Today's story Behind the Story will pose an interesting question. Did Napoleon Bonaparte actually die on the island of St. Helena, or did he manage to escape and return to Europe? First, a brief pause, and then I'll tell you some thoroughly documented facts which indicate that Napoleon met a death as ironical and unsuitable as his life had been spectacular in our story Behind the Story. Today's story Behind the Story enters the field of conjecture, of might have been. The theme of our guesswork is this. Did Napoleon Bonaparte really die on the remote island of St. Helena in exile? Or did he manage to escape and get back to Europe? First, let's take a look at what is called historical fact. After his overwhelming defeat at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, Napoleon was forced to abdicate his throne. For a short time, nobody knew what to do with him. Napoleon himself suggested that he would retire from government and warfare and sail to the United States, where he would be willing to live simply and quietly as an ordinary citizen. But it was obvious to all the great powers that as long as this man was alive and at large, even if he did claim to be in retirement, he was the most potentially dangerous figure in the world. However, no nation wished to be responsible for his execution. The British hoped the new French king would have him guillotined. But the French, Louis XVIII, knew better. With as many rabid followers as Napoleon still had in France, he refused to so much as lay a hand on the ex-emperor. Finally, Napoleon threw himself on the mercy of the English, asking to be allowed to come and live in England as a harmless refugee. The British made up their minds. They sent several warships to the French coast to pick up Napoleon and several of his friends. But instead of carrying him to Great Britain, they took him to the lonely rocky isle of St. Helena, far out in the Atlantic Ocean. Here they informed him he would stay for the rest of his life. He would not be confined to his quarters. In fact, he could roam over the better portion of the island. He could even have an occasional visitor. But the only land his feet would ever touch from that day onward would be the stony soil of St. Helena. History goes on to tell us that Napoleon was kept under constant surveillance, that he was never left completely alone in his limited freedom. His spirits drooped. He felt he'd been betrayed by the British. He became bitter and sullen, and finally very ill. A short 6 years after he arrived on the island, he died on May 5, 1821. So much for history. Ever since that time, a few inquisitive scholars and historians have insisted that it was not Napoleon who died at St. Helena. that Napoleon escaped in 1818 and returned to Europe, where he finally died, in any one of a number of ways. Here the theories differ. But they all agree that the great Bonaparte did fly his prison in 1818. Let's go behind the story and review the evidence. In the first place, a great many years before the fall of the mighty eagle, he decided that his presence was demanded at more functions than he was physically able to attend. So Napoleon had his minister of police, Fouche, take care of a very delicate assignment. Fouche called in one of his best officers, a man named Ledru, and told him,
"I am about to assign you, Monsieur Ledru, to a task so delicate, of such great secrecy, that not only does your life depend on it, but perhaps the future of our glorious France."
"Monsieur Fouche, my life is at the disposal of my country. I have never failed France before."
"Very well. Monsieur Ledru, it is essential that His Imperial Majesty, the Emperor Napoleon, have a double."
"Parbleu! You mean I must find a man who looks exactly like the Emperor?"
"Precisely. And it must be a man whose loyalty to Napoleon is beyond question, who would gladly give up his life for His Majesty if need be. Above all, he must know how to keep his mouth shut."
To find a man who looked exactly like Napoleon and yet was devoted to his ruler, Ledru went to the most likely place, the French army. All the soldiers worshipped Napoleon, who would always be their general to them, not their monarch. And Ledru found his man. He was an infantryman named François Robot, and he was almost overcome by the honor for which he had been singled out. He held his secret position until Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo. Then he was free to return to his home in Balaycourt. This much Ledru revealed many years later in his memoirs. He also stated that a few months after Waterloo, the mayor of Balaycourt, who was not an admirer of Napoleon, frantically summoned the king's secret police.
"Monsieur, those of us who know some state secrets have been able to guess that Bonaparte had a double for himself, a man who came from this town. He returned here after that devil abdicated. But now he is again gone, disappeared without a word. Poof! You must tell His Majesty King Louis that we, his loyal subjects, suspect that some evil plot is underway to allow Napoleon to reappear."
The authorities quietly searched for Robot for a while, but found no trace of him. After a few months, the incident was forgotten. But today, if you should check the Balaycourt town registry, you will find listed under the name of Eugène Robot, died in St. Helena on, and the date has been inked out. Does this mean that Robot took his idol's place on the island and that it was he who died there in 1821? There's no record that Robot ever visited St. Helena. One thing is certain. A great change came over Napoleon during his imprisonment in the year 1818. A Miss Maud Ritchie, who had known the emperor well in Paris, visited St. Helena after his third year of exile and was amazed at the difference in his appearance his illness had caused. Why, he'd hardly recognized her. Here's another factor. General Bertrand, a close friend of Bonaparte's, had accompanied his commander to St. Helena. In the last years of Napoleon's life, before his death in 1821, observers were amazed at the brusqueness and disrespect with which Bertrand addressed the fallen monarch. Even his personal position seemed unnecessarily rude to him. True, he was no longer a great ruler. But would these men have treated an old friend that way, particularly a man they had idolized and to whom they had dedicated their lives? Among Napoleon's original companions on the isle was the Count de Las Cases, who wrote a work called Memorial of St. Helena, a great tribute to a great leader. He left the island in 1818, the year of the supposed escape. Why didn't he linger till Napoleon's death, unless he knew that his imperial companion was really a substitute? If it was Robot who consented to take Napoleon's place, he must have been well paid. Well, in 1818, Robot's sister left their hometown of Balaycourt for the larger city of Tours, where she lived very comfortably for the rest of her life with no visible source of support. Her son became a well-to-do magistrate. Another point is that General Bertrand's wife wrote again in 1818 to a friend in Russia, saying, "At last we have triumphed. Success is ours. Napoleon has left the island." Now, that sounds pretty positive, doesn't it? And finally, Napoleon, or the man whom the world thought was Napoleon, wrote a will a few weeks before he died. A prominent handwriting expert read that will and said,
"The handwriting of Napoleon in his will shows the effect of his sickness. It is only in rare instances here that one can recognize the genius of the author, which is most marked in earlier specimens of his writing. It is the handwriting of a weakened man, one who has greatly changed. Well, how could Napoleon escape?
There are many theories about this point. It's certain that Napoleon had thousands of loyal followers, not only in France, but all over the world. Several early plots for his rescue were actually uncovered. The Rothschild family, the great Parisian bankers, were most anxious to have him return. Their private papers revealed that they were making careful plans for such a coup. The actual method of effecting the rescue should have been relatively simple, with such powerful supporters to make the arrangements. So, suppose Napoleon did escape by one means or another. What became of him? There are many theories about that, too, but here's the most logical one. In 1818, a Frenchman opened an optician's shop in Verona, in Italy. His resemblance to the exiled emperor was so great that all his neighbors remarked about it. They even called him Napoleon as a nickname. One day in 1823, he dropped in to see the shopkeeper next door, a jeweler named Petrucci. He said,
"My friend, I'm going away on an important journey. I will be leaving the city for a short time. But I must return before 3 weeks have passed. If I am not back at the end of that time, I have here a letter. I rely on your honor not to open it. Send this letter to the King of France."
To the King of... Mamma mia! You forgot the powerful of France, Napoleon!
The optician did not return. Petrucci, who was an honest man, sent the letter as he had promised. In a few days, a French officer arrived, cleared everything out of the optician's shop, and then gave Petrucci 100,000 crowns to be absolutely silent about the whole affair. After 30 years, Petrucci finally told the story. It raided a lot of space in the newspapers for a while, but was quickly forgotten. The French optician left his shop in Verona on August 23, 1823. On September 5, 1823, a Viennese policeman saw a shadowy figure trying to climb the wall which led into the grounds of Schönbrunn, the summer palace of the Austrian royal family in Vienna. He shot the intruder. As he lay dying, the stranger murmured in French,
Duke of Reichstadt, King, son.
The Duke of Reichstadt was Napoleon's son, then living in Austria. The next day, officials from the French embassy claimed the body. They seemed very excited and alarmed. Nothing more was ever said of the incident. Now, all the occurrences I have told you are documented facts. Of course, they don't actually prove that Napoleon did escape from St. Helena. But wouldn't it be an ironic twist of fate if the great conqueror of Europe did flee from his last imprisonment, only to perish as a poor vagrant from a night watchman's bullet? Our next story behind the story will delve into the fascinating field of American place names. Most of us take the names of cities, states, of our country itself, pretty much for granted. You may be surprised to hear where some of these names originated, and how much heated argument went on before they were finally standardized in their present form. Until then, this is Marvin Miller transcribing So Long from Hollywood.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Be with us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our memories and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend, Singin' Sam, saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate producer, Cam Currier. Special research by Martin Halperin, and I'm Bill Browning. Our guest of honor, Marvin Miller, returns next week for the final chapter in his radio memoirs. From his personal transcription file, we'll hear such favorites as The Railroad Hour, Tell It Again.
I know you won't want to miss it, so be sure to be with us next week at this same time
same station.